ready to keep you company wherever you are. Carte Blanche, the podcast, brings you immersive, hard-hitting stories anytime, anywhere, every week.
Another week, another jam-packed episode of The Whole Week Wrap with Daily Maverick and Carte Blanche. Joining us this week is Business Maverick editor Nisa Moodley. Here's what's coming your way. Cape Town's criminal underworld is up for grabs following Mark Liffman's murder. Then, caught in a debt spiral, it's time for government to clean house.
Government needs political will to get its finances in order, and it needs to make commitment, and then, like I said in my article, they need to hold the line.
Later, spam calls be gone. And how well do you know your national symbols? But first, it's been called one of the biggest, most dramatic political comebacks in recent history. As Donald Trump wins a second term in the Oval Office, his election victory reveals a lot about the American voter. With just over half of the U.S. voting population saying, yes, we want more of Trump, his presidency is sure to deliver a fair amount of chaos. But with promises of better living conditions, most Americans are seemingly more than willing to put up with it. The rest of the world be damned. Nisa, welcome back to The Whole Week Wrap. It's always lovely having you on the show. How are you doing?
I'm great, Lizanne. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for asking. Now, the big story that's been on everyone's lips this past week is, without a doubt, the U.S. elections. Let's get into it. Firstly, what do you make of the election results?
Sure. I think a lot of people were very optimistic when Kamala got in the race. And it would have been fantastic to have a Black woman as the president of America for the first time. So I think those of us that are optimists were actually taken by surprise at the shift, because it seemed at the outset that Kamala was definitely gaining traction and popularity. And then suddenly at the last minute, it just all swung the other way.
Yeah. And you just see the sea of red taking over the state. Now, a few things are likely to happen now that Trump is entering his second term as president of the United States. First, many analysts are saying that the January 6th insurrectionists will most likely be pardoned. I mean, we've had Trump making a number of clemency promises throughout his campaign. There will also be a seismic shift in terms of immigration policy. But I think the big thing for us is what this all means for South Africa.
So I think the Rand did dip. In fact, I think we had a headline saying the Rand tanked. It shifted down about 3%. But I believe it kind of recovered. And I think that's a normal currency reaction to something as big as a new American president. The AGOA thing is really something we need to worry about, because Trump has been quite vocal about his views on tariffs. And so that would have immense implications for South Africa. I mean, we export quite a lot to the US on the back of that AGOA agreement.
Yes. And, you know, I think South Africa and Africa as a whole doesn't really feature much in terms of priorities for Trump. I think your colleague Tim Cohen summed it up perfectly. He writes, quote, Trump's interest and knowledge about not only South Africa, but the continent as a whole is palpably minuscule. Africa just doesn't feature, unquote. So I think there's a lot of uncertainty as well about what implications his presidency could have on South Africa trade relations, what policies he will be putting in place and how that will impact us. So there's a lot of uncertainty around that. But I also want to touch a bit on just what this vote tells us about America, because ultimately this is still democracy at work. I think whether you're a Trump fan or not, the people have voted. And it just kind of makes me question what this says about the American people. Is this a case of the US population having become more extreme right wing, or is it simply a case of people voting on bread and butter issues, which I personally think is the case? You know, things such as gender equality and raging wars in other parts of the world just don't carry as much weight as the issues of immigration, job creation, and economic policies.
I think you're quite right. It is very much a bread and butter issue. But I also think, Lazan, you know, if you look globally and on America over the last 5 to 10 years, it's just been a decade of these huge events and so much conflict and uncertainty. And people are still reeling from economic events that have put them on the back foot. And I think it's actually boiled down to a case of the better the devil you know than what you don't.
When speaking of Cape Town's shady criminal underworld, one name is destined to come up in conversation. Mark Liffman. Called a gangster, mafia boss, drug smuggler, and bully, Liffman's life was far from dull. But he maintained his innocence, telling Daily Maverick journalist Karen Dolly that it was all part of an ongoing smear campaign. Then, on Sunday, the 3rd of November, Liffman was gunned down outside a shopping center in George. And while his death marks a dramatic shift for some, the cycle of violence is, as Liffman once said, destined to continue. Last week Sunday, a central figure in Cape Town's criminal underworld, Mark Liffman, was assassinated outside a mall in George. Shortly after his murder, two men were arrested. They've already made their court appearance. And now it's kind of left this shady world of gangs and extortion mafias really tipped on its head as people kind of scurry around to find the next person to kind of fill Liffman's shoes. So this is really a seismic shift, I think, within the underworld, the criminal underworld that's really taken over Cape Town. So this has been such a big story. I think it's been quite scandalous for a lot of people, but it has very real implications as well for the people living in Cape Town. What was your response to this, the breaking news that Liffman was killed?
I think shock. It was so unexpected, despite the fact that he lived in such a murky underworld with all these security ties. You know, if you read Daily Maverick, Karen Dolly's done extensive reporting on Mark Liffman and that whole gang underworld. And her articles, as factual as they are, read a lot like a story out of the movies, because it's just unreal, the stuff that's happening below the surface that so many people walking around are completely unaware of.
Yes, definitely. I was just about to mention Karen Dolly's work, because, I mean, she's reported extensively on his life and his many connections to numerous alleged shadowy figures over the years. She's also written several books on the intricate criminal underworld. And it's, as you've said, it's quite unreal reading some of her articles, and even her most recent article in which she kind of reflects on her interactions with Liffman. It doesn't feel like real life, you know, some of the things that he said to her. So I really strongly suggest our listeners read Karen Dolly's piece dated the 6th of November. It gives you a really, really great overview of who Liffman was, the individuals he rubbed shoulders with. And it really serves as a sobering reminder that, you know what, there's always someone waiting in the wings to continue this cycle of crime. And I think that's a point she made really well in her latest article as well, that unfortunately, it's just going to continue. This doesn't really change anything, really.
No, I think the more things change, the more they stay the same. And it's almost like there's some mythical monster where you cut off the head and three grow back. And it almost feels a little bit like that kind of scenario.
When it comes to debt, South Africa finds itself in a very deep hole, one that's becoming more difficult to claw our way out of. With a current debt-to-GDP ratio of 75.5%, it's safe to say the country is facing a full-on debt crisis. So, how did we end up here, and how do we break free from this financial black hole that's sucking up any chance of economic growth? it's no secret, South Africa has a debt crisis, but it's really beginning to show its teeth in a very real and detrimental ways. You recently wrote a piece on the mini budget titled Mini Budget Blues. South Africa's huge debt repayment sucks up much of the fiscus. The piece contains some startling figures. The one that really stuck with me is that for every rand raised in revenue, 22 cents of that goes towards servicing debt. And that is just crazy to me.
And you know, the 22 cents to the rand figure, the frightening thing for me was that it was 20 cents to the rand as recently as February. So within less than a year, it's gone up. And 2 cents doesn't sound like a lot, but 2 cents of every rand raised in revenue. And when you look at the billions we've raised in revenue, then those numbers actually start to become really frightening, exactly like you said. And how did we get here? I think it's a fight to balance expenses and income. And revenue has dropped. It didn't meet the expectations we had. And then, you know, the wage initiatives, the wage bill that the public sector carries has taken up a large portion of spending.
And what's the solution to this? I know you mentioned a little bit in terms of the private sector getting involved. And I know during the mini budget, Gurungwana also made quite a number of comments regarding private-public partnerships, especially on infrastructure projects. So is that the best solution? What else can we do to get ourselves out of this debt crisis?
Well, I think the private sector coming on board to help with things like logistics and electricity supply, and we've seen great traction in that initiative. But I think the concern is, I want to warn or caution against people thinking private sector involvement means they're going to bail out the government or come to the board to help with the deficit. I don't think that is the case. I think it's got to be that government needs political will to get its finances in order. And it needs to make commitment. And then, like I said in my article, they need to hold the line. I almost had a picture of Braveheart in my head when I wrote that, you know, like hold the line, because there's this constant pressure for extra spending and there are needs. But it's almost like you have to really just be very focused and very set and firm in the path towards moving debt down.
From text messages to emails to phone calls, direct marketing has become the bane of our existence. It's everywhere and nearly impossible to stop. But now government is hoping new legislation could curb the wave of spam calls and messages. I want to know from you, how many spam calls and messages would you say you get on a daily or a weekly basis?
You know, it went through a phase where I was not getting spam calls, and now suddenly it's picked up again. But I have Truecaller on my phone, so I cut the calls off before. I don't even accept them at this point. And as soon as I cut the call, I block the number. But like that mythical monster, they just keep coming.
Exactly. And they're so frustrating, right? Because it feels very much like an invasion of privacy. I feel annoyed. I feel kind of like attacked almost. I really have a very visceral response to it. And I think a lot of our listeners can relate to that. But the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, or the DTIC, is looking to address this through a set of draft regulations that would better regulate unwanted direct marketing messages. So how will these regulations potentially prevent spam from flooding our devices? What are they putting on the table to help us rid ourselves of invasive marketing calls?
So one of the things that they're saying is that there's no provision for once you've opted in. So, you know, when you get that little agreement or you sign something, there's normally a little box that you have to tick, which either says, I agree to receive marketing material, or I don't agree. And you've got to read very carefully, because sometimes you tend to tick these boxes by default and you don't really, you know, if somebody has switched the words, then you might be actually agreeing to something you don't want to agree to. The problem is once you've opted in and you've said yes, then it's not that easy to actually reverse that action and say, sorry, I changed my mind. The answer is no. And so they're looking at an opt-out registry where you sign up and basically once you're on that registry, it means direct marketers can't contact you.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people thought that the POPI Act would address this, but that's not necessarily the same situation. The POPI Act is more about how your info is shared, where this regulation specifically focuses on helping you opt out of these marketing agreements or ensure that companies cannot contact you if you have registered to not be contacted by companies. So that's the difference. So POPI Act didn't really address this part of it. And now government is hoping that through this new regulation, that would be kind of addressed. Now, whether this will actually result in less spam calls and messages remains to be seen because, you know, ultimately the direct marketing companies, they still need to make money at the end of the day. So we'll have to see whether the new regulations actually make a tangible difference. Of course, our listeners are able to comment on the draft regulations. You can send an email to ssasayi@thedtic.gov.za. The deadline for submissions is the 15th of January, 2025. So if you want to be part of this and have your comments shared with government, you can, of course, send an email. From cows to dragons and even unicorns, national symbols serve as a visual representation of a country's identity, values, and hopes, regardless of race, gender, or political persuasion. Just one problem. When it comes to South African citizens, almost no one really knows what our national symbols even are. Let's wrap up today's show with something a little bit off key, and another question for you. Do you know all five of our national symbols?
I have to confess, I don't think I knew all five. I certainly didn't know we have a national fish. I knew about the springbok, the blue crane, and the protea.
Yes. Admittedly, I could only name four because I completely forgot about the national tree. I think it's a yellowwood or something like that.
Yeah.
But the reason I'm asking this question is because a recent survey by environmental scholars showed that only 3%, that's 3% of South Africans could name all five national plants and animals. And added to that, the survey found that only a fraction of that 3% had proper knowledge of each of these national symbols. It's a really fascinating study. We associate these symbols more with like sporting events. You know, you have the springboks and the proteas, but you don't really think, I mean, where in the world have you seen the Galjoen feature in terms of national sports or events? I haven't. So I'm kind
maybe
of like
the
thinking,
swimming team.
Maybe, yes. But, you know, some of us might be thinking, who cares, really? Because you think it's just a bunch of random symbols. But national symbols play an important part in our collective identity. I think, you know, we think of the springboks and the proteas, but it also unites people and kind of serves as a representation of the spirit of South Africa, whatever Galjoen means. I still don't know, but it's there. I think we need to acknowledge that we have these national symbols and maybe find more intriguing ways to incorporate them into our daily events that we host.
Absolutely. You know, I have to say the area I live in is on the west coast of South Africa. And so quite often when I'm out driving between these vast veld areas, there's springbok on the side of the road. And there are two specific fields where I know I will sometimes see a blue crane, which, by the way, they're very beautiful. And it just fills me with a sense of pride. But over and above that, and you know, the sporting nation like South Africa, it's terribly tied to rugby and cricket. But the fascinating thing for me about national animals was the story about China, because, and I read this, I think, about 2 years ago, and it just stuck with me. China's national animal is the panda. And China, when they are trying to foster good international relations with other countries, they gift them with pandas.
Oh, which wow.
Which is fascinating. Like, apparently they've been doing this since the 50s.
Well, maybe we can give everyone a Galjoen and a yellowwood tree.
I like the yellow and tree idea for sure.
Well, this brings us to the end of today's show. Nisa, as always, this has been a wonderful chat. We've covered a lot of ground today and a lot of varying topics. So thank you so much for making the time to chat to us. And as always, I wish you a wonderful week ahead and I look forward to our next chat.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Lavan. It was great fun.
Thanks for listening. Catch us again next week for another Whole Week Wrap. Until then, why not join the conversation on Twitter, Facebook, and everywhere else? We always love hearing from you.